From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Nabil Biagio, reporter for VOA's popular South Sudan in Focus. Our topic on this edition of the program, the world's youngest country, South Sudan, turns 10. Our guest, Ambassador Tom Hushek, former U.S. ambassador to South Sudan. While Khartoum grabs international headlines given the recent military coup, Juba has no shortage of problems and promise. After 22 years of brutal civil war between the mostly Arab Muslim North and the mainly Black Christian South, the people of South Sudan chose to secede from the North in a 2011 referendum. Seeking immediate legitimacy, the newly minted South Sudan quickly joined both the United Nations and the African Union. As it marks its 10th anniversary of independence, the world's youngest country suffers from widespread hunger and poverty, civil unrest, and internal displacement. In just 2 years after achieving independence from the North, South Sudan plunged into its own civil war. In December 2013, President Salva Kiir accused his former deputy, Riek Machar, and 10 others of attempting a coup d'etat. Machar denied the allegation and fled to lead the Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition. Fighting broke out between the SPLM in opposition or anti-government forces loyal to Riek Machar and Salva Kiir's Sudan People's Liberation Movement. After 5 years of devastating war, in 2018, President Salva Kiir and Riek Machar signed a peace accord with the hopes of ending the crisis and improving the lives of millions of South Sudanese. According to Human Rights Watch, in February 2020, they formed the revitalized Transitional Government of National Unity. However, the peace deal is tenuous, and sources say it does not address the root causes of the war, including grudges between the country's leaders. Ambassador Hushek, who has extensive experience in South Sudan, as well as in many other conflict-ridden regions, will discuss the myriad challenges that South Sudan continues to face as it strives to live up to its human and natural potential. Ambassador Hushek joins us via Microsoft Teams. Welcome to the program, Mr. Ambassador.
Thank you. It's good to be here, and it's good to make sure that there continues to be some focus on South Sudan. It's part of a very busy neighborhood with conflicts that are getting a lot of attention in Ethiopia and Sudan. And so I'm always glad when some of that attention can still go to South Sudan.
Well, absolutely. And we're delighted to have you. And I'm also very happy to welcome my colleague, Nabil Biagio, a reporter with VOA's South Sudan in Focus program. Nabil, welcome to you.
It's a pleasure. It's nice to be on here speaking with the ambassador.
So, without further ado, Mr. Ambassador, you know, a recent Washington Post article by Rachel Chasen paints a very dire humanitarian portrait of the country on its 10th anniversary, saying that 1.6 million people are internally displaced, 2.3 million are in neighboring countries, and two-thirds, Rachel says, of South Sudanese residents rely on humanitarian aid. And of course, this is during a time when donor countries have been hard hit by the coronavirus pandemic. They're dealing with other crises, as you alluded to, such as Ethiopia and Sudan. So funding has decreased. What's your take on the country today?
It's a country that faces so many challenges. Really, the numbers are off the charts. A lot of news on Afghanistan and the growing food insecurity there, but the percentages in South Sudan are even much higher. And really, in almost every category, it stretches the imagination of what can be done, what needs to be done. One of the themes that came out in Rachel Chasen's recent article was just the severe trauma that the country is facing. And this trauma, which is a result of the years of conflict, is something that is an obstacle to rebuilding, to building peace and democracy and a new social compact. It's going to be a tough place for many years to come, but the idea that came out in that article, I think, is that this work needs to be going on now. We can't let this situation just linger without the attention of the world, the South Sudan's neighbors, and giving the citizens there some breathing space.
I'd like to turn to my colleague Nabil Biagio, who has really his finger on the pulse of what's going on. Nabil.
Thank you, Carol. Mr. Ambassador, you were ambassador to South Sudan between 2018 and 2020. You witnessed the signing of the last peace agreement and the beginning of its implementation. And while the agreement technically ended the war, the chronic problem of intercommunal violence persisted, even increased. Revenge killings, cattle raiding, child abductions, violent land grabbing. We report on these incidents every day on South Sudan in Focus. And in their totality and persistency, they constitute a serious threat to the agreement and perhaps even indicate a serious flaw in the agreement to begin with. What are your thoughts around these issues and how do you see them resolved?
You're right. The civil war in South Sudan was one of the most violent in the world. A State Department-sponsored study put the number of excess deaths in less than 4 years at 400,000 people. So this is just a huge percentage of the populace is affected directly by the civil war. But even without that larger civil war waging as a result of the peace agreement, you're right, the local conflicts remain very intense and are taking just as many victims as the civil war. No study done yet on those numbers. But it shows that the peace agreement in itself isn't sufficient to build peace in the country. A lot more effort has to be put into it. Also, the peace agreement hasn't had the ability yet to really forge a new social compact to make sure that the government starts acting in the interests of the people rather than in the interests of a really entrenched patronage network. So building peace, building democracy is going to take a lot more effort than just the signing of this paper.
Another question, which is very pressing here. Recently, the need to hold elections in South Sudan has been touted quite a bit. South Sudanese have not voted since independence in 2011, as you know. President Salva Kiir is on record promising elections in 2023. And according to the peace agreement, elections would have been held in 2022. But extensions and delays in implementing the peace and with key provisions not yet implemented, especially security arrangements, many observers don't see 2023 as a realistic timeline. How do you see this situation playing out, and what should the U.S. and other partners of South Sudan do to ensure a smooth transition where the nation achieves democratic rule through elections at the end of the transitional period?
Yeah, the transitional and the constitutional processes in the peace agreement really are moving way too slowly. The first thing I'd want to say is that the people of South Sudan, like people anywhere in the world, have the right and deserve to be able to elect their own officials. And this hasn't been the case in the entire history of this young nation. Getting to a point where elections can take place, free and fair elections, elections that are not destabilizing further, is going to take a lot of work. And we really ought to already be investing in that work. This is something that, you know, you can't just pull off the shelf 6 months or a year before an election. A lot of work has to be done. And really, even just investing in things like political polling capacity in the country would do tremendous good to help give the tools to civil society that they will eventually need to not just hold elections, but actually to govern fairly in the country. Some of the efforts towards national dialogue or other dialogue programs at the community level could be amplified and taken advantage of to prepare for elections. The national dialogue that was sponsored by the incumbent government and so wasn't seen by everybody as totally inclusive did have the ability to collect opinions from people around the country, what they would expect of their government. And some of the conditions that the national dialogue discussed and concluded had to do with the future elections. One of them being this big question of whether the current incumbent leaders, President Kiir and First Vice President Riek Machar, should even stand for election in the future. Now, those are things that the country has to still work out, but they are not moving forward very fast to work those out. Those are the kind of things that need to be discussed and considered now, well in advance of an election. And already, as you indicated, Nabil, the timelines are already passed. So this needs to be work. And it's there are some of these activities that I think donor countries and the friends and neighbors from the African Union and IGAD could be already helping invest in. One other thing I should raise, just in case it doesn't come up, but the peace agreement also calls for a certain amount of transitional justice to deal with the atrocities that did take place during the Civil War. And that will also be something that probably needs to start now, but probably will continue throughout and then after an election.
And given all that work, would you say realistically South Sudan would be able to hold elections in 2023?
It would be incredibly challenging. And again, elections not just for the sake of elections, but elections that produce a government that's willing to administer the country in a way that's fair to the people, that is designed to help the people rather than to promote a patronage network. So this is going to be incredibly difficult task. It's not something I think that they currently are on a timeline to complete. It's just not realistic looking at what's happening now to expect that to be done. I'm stopping short of saying it shouldn't be done. I mean, this should be the aim, to move forward aggressively to get the people a chance to exercise their democratic rights. But realistically, I don't see that that kind of energy is being put into it and resources.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Ambassador Tom Hoshek, former U.S. Ambassador to South Sudan. I'm Carol Castiel, along with Nabil Biagio, reporter for VOA's South Sudan in Focus. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Here's a shout out to a loyal Facebook fan, Nicholas Atiogbe from Ghana. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter. Well, now back to our special guest, Ambassador Tom Hoshek, to talk more about the situation in South Sudan on its 10th anniversary. Mr. Ambassador, with regard to people in these internal displacement camps, the article by Rachel Chasen in the Washington Post suggests that the UN troops have left, and so now these camps are being overseen by South Sudanese soldiers, and of course there's still quite a bit of mistrust. To what do you attribute this? And because the 2018 peace deal included creating a unified army, what are the divisions that still remain between Salva Kiir and Machar's factions? What is the situation with regard to their relationship? Are things any different than 5 years ago? Because as the article suggests, there's still quite a bit of mistrust and people are concerned about the departure of UN troops.
Rachel's article used as a starting point, a hook, the story about the camp in Bentiu, where the UN forces are no longer providing the primary security. These camps were opened in the heat of the conflict when the Civil War first started and people fled to UN properties. And the UN rightly opened its doors and really prevented an atrocity from happening and saved a lot of people's lives. The former head of the UN in South Sudan once told me that that single decision by the United Nations to open its doors to civilians probably saved more lives than any other decision the UN ever took. So those camps were established that way, but with the large number of people or the large percentage of the population displaced, those camps only held about 10% of the internally displaced people in South Sudan. And it was taking a huge percentage of the UN's or the peacekeepers' resources to protect them. So the UN had to try to rebalance a little bit, provide some of its peacekeeping resources to protect people throughout the country. And they made this very difficult decision that they couldn't provide direct security for all these camps. Now, that's something even Rachel's article was very careful to show, that they were watching closely, seeing how it would turn out. It was not a comfortable decision by anybody, I don't think. And Bentiu is a particularly difficult place. I'm glad she featured it in her article. And it goes to the second part of your question, Carol, which is, what is the state of play among the competing groups? In Bentiu, you see that it has all the elements of competing political groups, that have competing militias, but also there are ethnic lines there that are very distinct, and there are economic resources that not everybody has access to, including jobs and employment. So people that are trapped in a camp can't necessarily find employment. Women who have to go outside the camp to find water can be subject to serious abuses, including mass rapes that have happened in that area of the country. So these are things that everyone is watching closely. Not a comfortable decision, but with the limited resources the UN has compared to the needs throughout the country, even just taking care of displaced people throughout the country, go beyond the needs that were being met in these particular camps.
Mr. Ambassador, could you expand a bit on underlying ethnic tensions between the two main groups, the Nuer and Dinka? Does that still exist? And we know that Salva Kiir is associated with the Dinka ethnic group, if I'm not mistaken, and Riek Machar with the Nuer. Talk about tensions, if they still exist. And also, as you said, the economic issues. How is the country surviving beyond receiving humanitarian aid, which is not endless, and they're going to have to get back to economic activity?
Yeah, well, tensions do exist. South Sudan, I think, has 62 tribes. The biggest are the Dinka and the Nuer, both Nilotic tribes for the anthropologists out there. The tensions exist. The coalitions that are behind Salva Kiir and Riek Machar, it would be too simplistic to just call them Dinka and Nuer. Both coalitions include people from throughout the country. This was the theory and the philosophy behind the SPLM, and both sides lay claim to that name still. You see that Riek Machar still is calling his party or coalition the SPLM in opposition, and then the government is still the SPLM that was in government during the Civil War. Now they're both in government together, of course. So those competitions still exist, but there are a lot of other tribes that come into conflict in different parts of the country with them. There's a lot of militias that are sponsored by the factions that are not technically part of the factions, and they've been allowed to create a lot of the violence and even armed to do so. And so the patchwork is much more complicated than just the two tribes. That said, there are some national symbols, some things, national ideas and ideals that people in South Sudan really can get behind. One of them was independence. The percentage of people voting in the referendum for independence was huge across all ethnic groups, across all parties, across all regions. That is an idea that the people of South Sudan get behind. People love their national anthem. People love the new national flag of South Sudan, but that's not enough to patch the country together. You mentioned economics as a driver of conflict. It could also potentially be something that brings the country together. The idea of South Sudan was that the new government would use the resources it had to build a new nation, to pursue development, and that hasn't happened. The primary resource is oil. And a lot of the underlying drivers of conflict are fighting to get control over these kind of resources, oil, and then there's a few different mining interests as well. But oil is substantial. Like a lot of countries, it could either build the nation's wealth or it could fuel corruption and crime and conflict. And unfortunately, in Sudan, it's doing the latter. Corruption and conflict are the fruits of their oil wealth rather than development and progress.
Oil, of course, we know it's a curse, whether Nigeria or Angola, all this wealth, which could really benefit the people, unfortunately, goes into the pockets of some of the leaders. But a very quick question with regard to the role of the United States, because the U.S. played a huge role in pushing for South Sudan independence, as you know. Do you think that Washington, therefore, has a special responsibility in making sure this young country surmounts the daunting humanitarian, political, and economic challenges it faces as it tries to heal from this recent civil conflict and so much displacement?
I believe that the United States certainly has a historic relationship with what was Southern Sudan and is now South Sudan. And I believe it has responsibility to continue to partner with the country to try to get past this conflict and more development work, a better future, peace and prosperity for the country. I believe that is a continuing responsibility. I also think it actually makes good foreign policy sense You know, when you let a humanitarian disaster just fester, it eventually comes back to get the neighbors and to get at us. To me, that's one of the lessons of Afghanistan during the 1990s. We let a humanitarian disaster and human rights disaster just fester. And America was attacked directly from Afghanistan. I think that's the kind of thing we need to watch out for in South Sudan. If we don't remain involved in some way, it can actually get worse. It's hard to believe looking at the numbers, but it can get worse. You see what's happened in places like Somalia in the days when the civil war was running rampant. It took some international engagement to try to patch things together, and it's not an easy task. So I think we need to do that in South Sudan. The level of enthusiasm for South Sudan's independence was so high in America that when things came crashing back into civil war, so many of the policymakers just lost heart and they gave up and they've become very soured on it. And it's easy to understand why. But I don't think the answer can be disengagement. I think we have to remain engaged. Certainly, America has humanitarian principles that we always try to live up to, and we have been continuing humanitarian assistance in a large, large fashion in South Sudan, some of the biggest programs in the world, both bilaterally and multilaterally, which we fund, are in South Sudan, and that needs to be the case. But everybody wants to get to the place where you can start doing more development work. Unfortunately, the government has not proven yet to be a good partner in that. They can't provide the kind of accountability donors need for funding, for example. So a lot of the ways we can do development are quite limited, and we have to be creative and innovative. And South Sudan's always been a place that demands innovation in how we relate to a development challenge in a conflict area. When I was a junior officer, my first tour in Khartoum, Sudan, was when the U.S. really pushed the United Nations to begin Operation Lifeline Sudan, which really changed the rules about how the international community could provide humanitarian assistance, even in a place where the host government caused impediments and obstacles to that. And that innovation is still employed in various parts of the world, and it was invented for Southern Sudan. And I think today, even, we need to keep innovating and figuring out ways to make this work. The regular off-the-shelf ways of doing business don't work in a place that ridden by conflict as South Sudan. So we need to be innovative.
With that, let me turn to my colleague Nabil for another question.
Yes, I would like to pick up on the economy and accountability. The IMF released this month its nine-month review of South Sudan's staff-monitored program, which aims to stabilize the economy, carry out economic reforms, etc. And experts have always pointed out corruption and a lack of financial accountability and transparency as a factor underlying the conflict in South Sudan and the impoverishment of this young nation. The IMF has already allocated financial assistance worth more than $200 million to South Sudan since November 2020. What is lacking to achieve economic reforms that are much needed to rescue the state of South Sudan from the capture of corrupt officials, as described in some reports?
I think the number one lacking thing is sufficient political will. South Sudanese are as smart as any people I've ever met. There are good technocrats there who know how a budget should be run, who know how this could be done. But the political will to really use a rules-based approach to running the economy rather than a patronage-based approach, that political will is still too absent. You see glimpses of it, of course. There are some really good people there trying hard, some good ideas about how to build new institutions, but really the political will to get it done isn't there. And you don't have all the institutional checks and balances that will be needed. The transitional constitution has features that look really good on paper, but like a lot of places, they don't always become the reality. Parliament is supposed to play a very active role in crafting the budget and overseeing its implementation. But the year I left, there wasn't even a budget passed, and the budgets that had been passed previously weren't always followed, and they weren't always crafted in their best way. One area I look at is the investment levels of the national budget in health and education. And South Sudan's budget's always woefully underinvested in those areas, not even getting close to the Africa Union standard for budgetary inputs into health and education. And then even what was passed wasn't always actually spent in those areas. So yes, it's a poor country, but even for the small budget that they have, they weren't getting up to the percentages they were supposed to in health and education. So they were underinvesting in those and investing way too much of their money in armed forces that actually were dragging the country down rather than providing the kind of security that would allow for more stability and more investment. So stronger institutions, but those would be the result of political will. And as I said, political will still seems to be lacking, although it wouldn't hurt to have the African Union and the United Nations and other donor countries helping out a little bit more in building these institutions. But the main thing is the political will. And I think if that were to come along, you would see partnerships with the international community growing, and that kind of partnership could bring a lot of good to a country like South Sudan.
For my last question, I would like to turn to South Sudan's neighbor to the North, Sudan. How do you see the instability in Sudan affecting political stability in South Sudan, given that Sudan is the guarantor of South Sudan's peace agreement, but also generally the prospects of democratic rule in South Sudan, given the rise of military strongmen in Sudan, Sudan being South Sudan's most important neighbor?
Well, these are two countries that are inextricably linked. Their histories are linked. Even a diplomat like me has started out his career in Khartoum and finished up in Juba. And their peace processes are linked also. The peace process, the agreement that was signed in 2018 for South Sudan was signed in Khartoum, and it was brokered by the neighboring countries in general, the IGAD countries. But really, Khartoum played a very important role in that. And the peace talks that were ongoing for Sudan were taking place in Juba. So these countries, they have a mixed history. People share a lot of ties across the border. And a lot of that could be to the benefit of both countries. Open borders between the two countries would have an enormous positive humanitarian impact in both countries, and economic impact as well. But unfortunately, too often, I saw that South Sudan was drawing the wrong lessons from what was happening in Sudan. They were afraid of the idea of active civil society, street protests, forcing the government to do the right thing. They were afraid of that in South Sudan. And they always, when they had the coalition government that had military elements as well as civilian elements, they always leaned a little bit towards dealing with the military a little more readily than they did towards the other side. It's just something I think they would have drawn better lessons if they had leaned the other direction. But they're nervous about that as well. And that said, if stability is the end result in Sudan, I think that would have an extremely positive impact on South Sudan, too, as far as stability. Both countries play a role in extracting and capturing the wealth from the oil in South Sudan. Since the pipelines go through Sudan, you need Sudan to also be stable. And so the people in South Sudan should really be looking towards their neighbor and taking positive lessons from any forward progress in democracy, not taking negative lessons from that and thinking that they need more military or more security services to crack down. Unfortunately, they don't always take the right lessons from Sudan in South Sudan. There's also a few lingering issues from the divorce of the two nations. So there is the question of the status of Abyei district, which was never fully resolved in the peace agreement between Sudan and South Sudan. And having stability in both countries, I think, would give both governments the courage to tackle and find a good resolution for Abyei. There are issues like that also that keep the countries linked to each other. So I hope that the future of Sudan is democratic and stable and comes quickly. And I think if that happens, I hope that the leaders in South Sudan draw the positive lessons from that and also move in that direction.
Ambassador Tom Hoshek is former U.S. ambassador to South Sudan. Mr. Ambassador, I can't thank you enough for your time and your insights about one of Africa's newest nations, South Sudan. We greatly appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. And joining me on the program was Nabil Biagio, reporter for VOA's South Sudan in Focus. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.